but said, "Starving." David, it appeared, was having one of his good days. He said, "Then have a seat. With what I've got planned, you'll need your energy." She put on a devilish look. "Oh, really?" John had been awake for 22 hours already, and there was no sleep on the horizon, not when a girl could be getting molested, tortured, eaten, or God knows what at the hands of God knows who. So, John swung by his house and changed out of his court appearance clothes, downed a mug of coffee, ate two Hostess cupcakes, and finished it off by smoking some crystal meth. Soon, he was back behind the wheel of the Ezekiel Jeep and heading toward the church, feeling good as new. Everybody likes to get preachy about drugs, John thought, because it's a handy way to deflect from their own, even worse, vices. Dave drank every night and rarely ate a meal that didn't leave a grease stain behind. Amy ran on sugar, caffeine, and pain pills, and would sacrifice an entire night of sleep to level up a character in one of her games. The people with health insurance get antidepressants and Adderall, the rich get cocaine, the clean-living Christians settle for mug after mug of coffee and all-you-can-eat buffets. The reality is that society had gotten too fast, noisy, and stressful for the human brain to process, and everybody was ingesting something to either keep up or dull the shame of falling behind. For those few who truly live clean, well, it's the self-righteousness that gets them high. John headed for Mind's Eye, a spot so scenic that couples actually hold their weddings there. Well, the ones who don't know the backstory, anyway. The little church and several rental cabins sat up on a hill that encircled a small, weirdly colored pond. At the base of the hill, opposite the church, was the entrance to what had been a coal mine back in the 1800s, before it collapsed in a horrific disaster. Nobody ever attempted to reopen it because, you guessed it, the circumstances of the disaster were creepy as shit. The miners had collapsed the shaft in on themselves with dynamite, supposedly in order to stop what was in there from getting out. They had sent out one guy, the youngest, to tell everyone else not to attempt a rescue. The town dealt with it in the usual way, which was to simply put up a sign warning people away and otherwise never think about it again. The whole area in front of the mine had filled with water over the decades, the mouth now appearing to be frozen in the act of puking loose rocks into the new pond. The minerals in the rock would turn the water emerald green, teal, or cobalt, depending on the color of the sky. So, on a clear day, there'd be this vivid shimmering pool that stood out sharply from the landscape around it, like a magical eye had opened. The church up on the hillside had been built after the collapse, as if someone had planted it there as a safeguard. John followed a narrow road around the hilltops, passing the cabins and arriving at the church, which had a sign out front with whimsical slogans they swapped out every week. Today's, "Choose your afterlife, smoking or non-smoking." John thought the building itself did in fact look like someone had taken a church symbol on a map and blown it up to life size. Tiny building, white painted wood, ornate doors on the front with a cross and steeple overhead. Two stained glass windows on either side of the door. It also looked just like Maggie's drawing, though if you grabbed 100 children and made them draw you a church, they'd all look like that. Again, shitty artists. John reached the parking lot and found that Dave hadn't arrived yet, so he pulled up to wait for him, keeping an eye out for any horror that might be occurring. He tapped his fingers on the steering wheel. He realized he was clenching his jaw and forced himself to stop. He grabbed the coins out of the center console. He polished them with his shirt one by one, then placed them on the seat next to him in order of value and then date minted. He found he was clenching his jaw again. There was a scream. He was sure he had heard it. A little girl. John jumped out of the Jeep. He reached into the back seat and pulled out the t-shirt cannon. He ran up to the front doors, found them locked, then asked the Lord for forgiveness a split second before he kicked his way through. Thunder clapped as John stepped through the entryway, shirt cannon at the ready. A half dozen doves flew past him out the door. Standing at the pulpit was a thin, shirtless man holding a cigarette. Ted had described Nymph as a creepy sexual deviant type, but John didn't get that vibe from the guy at all. He had slicked back hair and narrow, dismissive eyes. He struck John as a cutthroat stockbroker type, a guy who would sever a friendship over a lost game of racquetball. A small man, but wiry, tight, compact muscles. The wind picked up, and the walls creaked under the strain. The rain went horizontal, spraying into the open door behind John. He slammed the door closed behind him with a backward kick. John said, "Mr. Nymph, I presume?" The guy took a drag off his cigarette and said, "Congratulations on following a series of groaningly obvious clues. When you enter a room, do you see little equations flying around in front of your eyes?" John brandished the gun. "Where is she?" "You tell me, John. You've heard of us?" "I have." "Is that why you took the girl? To lure us in? Well, you've got us. Let her go. There's no reason to involve anyone else." "Yes, we wouldn't want to traumatize poor Ted any further, would we? Do you know why soldiers march in unison, or why they are compelled to chant in groups? It's a form of hypnosis. It overrides the brain's critical thinking centers. It's the same reason we make school children shout the Pledge of Allegiance every morning. But so difficult to adjust after the programming wears off. Tragic, really. And no, John, it turns out that in fact, there exist things in this universe that are not about you." Lightning flashed and brought a clap of thunder a half second later. Close. The wind picked up again. Outside, a branch was wrenched off of a tree. "What is it you want, then?" "The same as all of us want, to feed and to breed. Do you wish to guess which I intend for little Margaret Knoll? Perhaps both. She's still alive." Nymph took a drag off his cigarette. "Tell me, John, do you believe in the existence of the human soul?" "Oh, Jesus, I do not have time for this shit." Another blast of wind outside. Something heavy smacked into the wall. The ground shook with what John was certain was the impact of an entire tree collapsing nearby. The storm, bursting free of its restraints. "I don't think you have a soul. How about that?" "Now, we're getting somewhere. Why don't you think I have a soul?" "Because you're a sick fuck who kills little girls." "That tree that just fell, did it have a soul?" "You're stalling. I'm not playing your game." Nymph didn't answer, just stared and waited for John's reply. His silence, of course, made the statement for him. "You don't have any choice but to play." John growled, "No, a tree doesn't have a soul that I know of, but I also don't give a shit." "Of course it doesn't. It's just a series of chemical reactions, sun, water, air. It cannot refuse sunlight on moral grounds or share water with a more deserving tree. It's just a machine that soaks up whatever sustenance it encounters." The wind had become a steady howl, a sustained assault that whistled around the corners of the structure. There was a noise like something tearing loose from the roof. "I get it," said John, now having to raise his voice to be heard over the maelstrom. "Trees are stupid. Where is the girl, Maggie? Can you hear me? Does a maggot have a soul? Is this conversation going the way you planned it in your head? Do you sound clever, like an evil mastermind? Because if this was a video game cutscene, I'd be skipping past all this shit. Of course, a maggot is no more ensouled than a tree. Put it on a piece of rotting flesh and it will eat. The concept of not eating what is in front of it is utterly alien. So, what about you? Do you have a soul? Dave is going to be here any second. If I were you, I'd start cooperating before he walks through that door. See, I don't think he cares about getting answers. I think he just wants to see you bleed. I think he gets off on it. Undeterred, Nymph said, "Did you know that you can do a simple test to detect if a child has a soul? They did the experiment in the 1960s. You simply set an Oreo cookie on the table in front of them, tell them not to eat it, then leave the room. Some will resist until you return. The rest will reach out and eat it within minutes or seconds. Follow up with that latter group decades later, and you'll find they're all drug addicts or in jail. Or bankrupt, because they are maggots, you see. Tell me, John, would you have passed this test?" John could barely hear the man. The storm was now an enormous animal, frantically gnawing away at the wooden shell of the church to get to the soft meat inside. John edged toward Nymph. He would only get one shot at this, meaning his weapon literally only had one shot. Nymph said, "We know the answer to that, don't we? You undergo that test every single day. But I've wasted enough of your time. Why don't we go somewhere and talk this over like reasonable men? We're both reasonable men, aren't we?" Nymph stepped out from behind the podium. He was wearing nothing except for a tiny pair of little girl's panties, which did nothing to conceal his massive erection. The wind made the exact sound you hear when a freight train runs over your face. John ran at Nymph. With a hellish noise, the roof was ripped from the building. Me. I wrestled with the decision for a few blocks, but eventually decided to swing around and head for the apartment to get Amy. The wind was picking up and the storm was kind of getting scary. Other cars had pulled off the road completely, the drivers such pussies that they refused to drive unless they could actually see the road. When I made it home and climbed to the top of the dildo store, I noticed that the neon sign had gone dark. The power must have gone out. I entered quietly and thought I'd find Amy asleep, but a quick search revealed she wasn't home. This wasn't too alarming. She couldn't drive, but she still had lots of options. She could have hung back at work so as not to get out into the storm, or the dude giving her a ride may have had to run an errand on the way. She could have walked over to the convenience store across the street to get some junk food. I noticed there were dishes in the sink, used and then washed. A mixing bowl, a whisk, two plates. Had she invited that guy from work in for breakfast? If you don't know Amy, let me catch you up. That is absolutely not the kind of thing she does. Maybe the guy insisted. A box of Bisquick and a plastic bottle of pancake syrup were sitting on the counter. I tried to picture this dude insisting he come in to our apartment to make Amy pancakes in our kitchen, and her agreeing to that. My brain just froze up. I mean, if they had just succumbed to passion and banged in my bed, I could understand that. I wouldn't even be mad, as long as Amy was happy and they cleaned up afterward. But coming into another man's house and making breakfast for his girl in his own kitchen? That's some serial killer shit. Maybe somebody else stopped by. That's probably all it was. Hell, it's the sort of thing that on a different day wouldn't have triggered a second thought. I looked around for a note. Amy is big on leaving notes, and checked my phone to make sure I hadn't missed a message. Nothing. I just stood in the middle of the kitchen for a moment, rain and wind crashing against the windows. I wasn't worried, necessarily. What, like the bad guys came for her and made her breakfast first? I pulled out my phone and tried to call. I got a voice telling me the network was down. John. John flinched at the cacophony overhead, then looked up to see only sky. The entire roof of the church had been raggedly peeled off like the top on a box of macaroni and cheese mix. The storm washed in, and it was like he'd stuck his head into the water going 70 miles an hour on a jet ski. Half blind, John stumbled forward and reached the pulpit, trying to shield his eyes. Nymph wasn't there, but there was a door in the wall beyond. John reached it and found himself in a small break room. Another door to the outside was standing open. John pushed through into the storm, in time to see taillights swimming into the distance. John sprinted around to the jeep and tore through the storm in pursuit. The visibility was so poor, he had no idea if they were even on a road. All he could see were those blurry taillights on Nymph's car, a tiny black convertible. John didn't even consider backing off. He didn't know who or what Nymph was, and didn't particularly care. What John had learned was that anything and everything in this universe feels pain. It's the universal constant. It's what keeps us in check. In his time doing this job, John had learned how to inflict all types of pain on all types of creatures. For some, it was a blade. For others, sunlight, or the sound of a wind chime on a summer day. John would catch Nymph, and he would find out what caused Nymph pain. The taillights swerved and jerked in John's windshield, and each time John followed them. The car ran off the road and back on again, tires briefly spinning for traction on the muddy shoulder. Whatever Nymph was, John knew this. The guy had chosen the wrong vehicle for this pursuit. His little sports car lost speed in the muck and nearly hydroplaned when it hit standing water on the pavement, while John's jeep plowed ever forward. Finally, Nymph made the mistake John had been waiting for. On a long stretch of clear road, Nymph had floored it, racing off into the distance for a few seconds before he hit a large puddle and lost traction completely. John just saw a wild spray of white water, the taillights whipping left and then right. The crash was over before John's brain could even register what was happening. First, the little black sports car swerved right into a utility pole, head-on, the taillights bouncing on impact. A split second later, John smashed into the sports car, compressing it into the pole like a beer can. Between the two vehicles, it was no contest. The jeep had crushed the fragile little convertible to half its size. It didn't even bend the jeep's bumper guards. For a moment, all was still. John's fingers were locked in a death grip around his steering wheel. Steam hissed from an exploded radiator. Nymph's, not his. The wind had calmed, and once again it was just the steady rain, as if the gods' lust for violence had been appeased with a sacrifice. John gathered himself, yanked off his seatbelt, and stumbled up to the driver's side door of the sports car. He reared back with an elbow and smashed the window. Empty. No Nymph in the driver's side, or passenger side, or the floorboard. No break in the windshield where he could have flown through on impact. Nothing. John stomped back toward the jeep. Blood, dripping from the rear bumper. No. A little sports car like that wouldn't have much of a trunk in the best of times, but now it had been crumpled into a mangled space no more than a foot wide. The lid sat loosely on top, and under it, John could see the little girl looking mangled and bloody. Something. But it was impossible to know in the rain. If he never lifted the lid and got a closer look, maybe he could go the rest of his life never knowing what was in there. Like Schrödinger's cat, only by seeing what was in the trunk would it become real. John slowly lifted the lid, and he saw bloody little hands bound at the wrists by duct tape, and a round little face with its mouth taped shut. A tangle of blonde hair. Terrified eyes, wide open. Dead eyes. Margaret Maggie Knoll. Her fragile body obliterated on impact. John's heart was hammering. He couldn't breathe. He gently lowered the trunk lid, then growled and slammed his fist into the roof of the car again and again. He was screaming now. Somewhere, he thought he could hear Nymph laughing. John was making so much noise, in fact, that he almost didn't hear when a man said from behind him, "Did you get him? Did you get Nymph? John turned and saw Ted Knoll. Chapter 6. The rain continues, and also John dies. Ted was holding his shotgun, the barrel aimed down at the splattery pavement. John said nothing. I saw you tearing ass down the street. I was coming the opposite way, recognized your crazy Jeep. I did a bootleg turn and followed as best I could. Ted looked over the wreck. Is this his? Is Nymph in there? John still couldn't speak. Hey, man, are you hurt? Talk to me. Ted took a step forward. He saw the blood. He looked at the trunk, then he looked at John, piecing it together. John said, Don't look in there, man. Don't. What? Is it? Ted edged up to the car, the gun still pointed at his feet. Don't, man. Ted turned and met John's eyes, just stared at him, his face a cracked dam holding back a flood of contempt. Making very deliberate movements, Ted slowly opened the trunk and took in what he saw inside. John watched Ted's face. The whole mental process didn't take more than a minute. The man stared into the trunk, let the reality of it sink in, then squeezed his eyes shut and worked his jaw. Then he calmly closed the trunk and, without turning around, said softly, I thought I told you to call me. If you found Nymph, I said to call me instead of trying to handle it yourself. There was no time. Do you know why I asked you to do that? To call me? If I'd had a chance. Because, said Ted, sounding like he was using every ounce of his strength to contain himself, this wasn't a matter of who gets credit for taking down the bad man. This was about getting my daughter back. My daughter. Not yours. And unlike you, I have actual training. It wasn't my fault. Nymph, he took off. I followed. I thought I could tail him back to where he was keeping. What training do you have? For anything. What have you worked hard for your entire life? You sit at home, you play your games, you do your drugs, and then when the shit goes down, you fall apart and people die. Because you don't have the necessary skills. Because practice is boring. Listen, the guy who did this is still... Shut the fuck up! Ted raised the shotgun, pointing it right at John's face. The father of the dead child bared his clenched teeth, rage and despair wearing the rest of him like a suit. John put up his hands. Whoa! Look, calm down. I'm not who you're angry at here. We used to have this saying in the Marines, 10-10-80. 10% of people are heroes, 10% are assholes, and 80% are nothing. Just blobs that go along. Leeches. Sheep. You understand? The world isn't in the shitty state it's in because of people like Nymph. It's because of people like you. You're not thinking straight. You're... Hey! What's the password? What do you think this is? It's Bushmaster. And this is for Maggie. Ted fired. John ducked, not sure if the shot had missed or if he just hadn't felt himself die yet. Without pausing to find out which, John lunged for the gun. He didn't have a plan. He just wanted that barrel pointed in any other direction. He got his hands around the shotgun and shoved the barrel up, aiming it at the sky. John's and Ted's limbs tangled, and they went to the ground along the shoulder of the highway, splashing in the mud. Ted rolled over on top of John, rivulets cascading down around the man's face, his crazed eyes just inches away. The hot barrel of the gun was between them, touching John's chin. John growled and gritted his teeth and tried to shove off his attacker. Bang! And then there was a spray of warm blood, and Ted Knoll's face was gone. Me. I waited for the storm to calm, and then headed for the church at Mind's Eye, passing downed trees and severed limbs. When I got to the church, I found that their sign with the clever slogans had been crushed by a fallen tree. The roof of the church had also been damaged, and rain was cascading in. I didn't know if that part was because of the storm or something John had done. His methods aren't subtle. Otherwise, There was no sign of John or his vehicle. Had he already come and gone? Maybe he went somewhere to ride out the storm. Then I noticed the tire tracks, deep ruts and sprays of mud dug by a vehicle peeling out across a wet lawn. I could see where the tracks joined the inlet road that curved around the mine. This looked a hell of a lot like a pursuit. I checked my phone and again got the no network message. I followed the road for a stretch but found nothing, and soon I was passing multiple points where a chase could have branched off in different directions. Eventually, I just took two left turns and got pointed back toward town again. Well, shit, I've lost Amy and I've lost John within 5 minutes. By this afternoon, I'll be the last non-missing person in Undisclosed. Could they be together somewhere? Maybe he's the one who dropped by to have breakfast. I was lost, which, as you're probably gathering, is something of a regular state of being for me. My phone dinged the sound of an incoming text message. The cell network back up, apparently, and I got a text from John that said simply, "Girl's dead." And then it dinged again with a second message, "Find Nymph." And then, after some hesitation, a third, "I'm sorry." I called. He didn't answer. I texted back asking him to clarify. Fuck? I slammed on the brakes and did a U-turn in front of a honking car. I headed to John's house, the only place I could think to find him. What I fear most in this job, the sarcasm quotes are there to denote the absence of a paycheck, isn't some lumbering horror smashing its way through my windows. It's the groupies, obsessed fans who make the journey to Undisclosed based on the legends, like they expect to find a bus running monster tours around town. They come to try to get a glimpse of us, or to ask us to solve their problems, and or to tell them scary stories. This is why I never disclose the name of the town. The way I see it, the monsters might try to eat your soul, but at least they don't feel like they're owed anything. That's why I like to move around, from one apartment to the next, places that don't require a lease, rarely leaving forwarding addresses. Not that I still don't get my packages. The local postal workers know who I am. They make sure the bullshit arrives. John, on the other hand, bought a two-story house in town and proceeded to paint the entire thing flat black from top to bottom, including the roof and the windows. He joked that he was turning it into a stealth house. But of course the intention was the opposite. Every weirdo who managed to reverse engineer our location could spot that place from a mile away. I pulled up to that black house, John's Jeep in the driveway. I went around to the other parking spot at the rear and headed to the back door, hearing the dog yapping from inside. I wondered if I'd have to kick that door down, but it was unlocked. I turned the knob and prepared to be incinerated. Oh, that's the other thing. John's entire house is now booby-trapped. The doors, for instance, are surrounded by four nozzles that, in theory, will fire four jets of propane-fueled flames, instantly turning any intruder into an intruder who is on fire. Won't this almost certainly catch the exterior of the house on fire, you ask? Yep. And once the flaming intruder stumbles inside, the interior of the house will also be on fire. When I raised these concerns to John, he simply said, "It'd be worth it." I stepped inside, found that I was not ablaze, and called out to John. No reply. His Yorkshire Terrier, named Dioji, was at my ankles, barking his stupid head off. I told him to shut up. I started to reach down to him, then noticed I had the pink Disney phone in my hand. I'd grabbed it before I'd left the car, apparently, though I couldn't fathom why. I tossed it aside. In the photo on Nymph's phone, John was sprawled on the sofa, a cascade of dried vomit from his body having desperately spasmed out its contents prior to death. Entering from the back meant passing through the kitchen and into a partially open dining room, living room space that John had turned into what he called the parlor. John had decorated his home, either by accident or on purpose, to look like a more affordable replica of a rich person's house in a 1980s action movie. Furniture of black leather, chrome and glass end tables, massive sound system surrounding an even bigger TV, both purchased used. It was unspeakably awesome, in my opinion, cocaine decor on a crack budget. John and I don't talk about finances, just like we don't talk about a lot of things. Each of us could see the argument lurking in the dark, so we just never flip on the light. I said earlier that there are reasons I don't try to cash in on the freak show aspect of our lives, but those are my reasons, not his. John was never much for the 9-to-5, and I have caught wind of him doing everything from charging for email consultations for haunting victims to selling T-shirts. Occasionally, he'll ask if I want in on it, and I'll say no, and assume he knows I mean I don't want it to happen at all. He takes it to mean I just didn't want any of the money. The living room area was just ahead, the sofa obscured from view behind a section of wall to my right. I didn't move. I knew I was stalling. I didn't care. In the photo, there were drugs on the glass coffee table, a variety of them, an overdose buffet. I called out for John a second time, and once again, got no answer. I didn't expect one. Where a lesser person would have had a dining room table, John had a pool table. On the green surface were painted the words, "In here, doom." I ran my hand along the felt as I glanced around the room. One end of the pool table was too close to the wall, and you couldn't extend your cue fully on the shots. It was a key part of the strategy to keep your balls away from that rail. The white wall bore scuff marks from the butts of cues striking it on the backswing, each mark representing a ruined shot. In the corner were stains on the carpet from where Crystal and Nikki had spent 2 hours on the body paint job that would get John arrested. It was Halloween, all right? On the ceiling was a faint chili stain from the rowdy aftermath of Guilty Pleasure Movie Night. Amy's had been Twilight, mine was Weird Science, John's was Dude, Where's My Car? All these memories. Maybe I'll just stand here forever, thinking about them, instead of going into the living room and seeing what's in there. I thought, if you never look, it's never real. And for some reason, I heard it in John's voice. Peering into the living room, I could see where above the mantle of the fireplace, John had mounted two huge chainsaws, their 36-inch blades forming an X. Dioji was busy yapping away, bouncing on his little paws with each bark. It was driving me fucking crazy. I forced my legs to move. The sofa slowly came into view, and I saw the bottom of one of John's Converse All-Stars jutting out over the armrest, lying at an unnatural angle, not moving. I could smell the gut-turning odor of a body that had purged itself at the moment of catastrophic failure. I came around, and there he was. And there was the stream of drying vomit, and there on the coffee table was a light bulb with a plastic straw jutting out the back, a homemade pipe. One half of the bulb was charred from where he'd touched it with the lighter, again and again. And there was a bottle of pills, and there was a syringe full of whatever. This was not the aftermath of a quick midday pick-me-up. This was someone coming home and cooking up a combination intended specifically to stop his heart in a way that would be painless. I know because I had spent some time researching the method myself. I felt for a pulse. No need. He was cold. Half of my universe went dark. I collapsed into the black leatherish chair opposite the sofa. The dog, maybe sensing my mood, finally stopped barking. "I'm sorry." His last words had been a fucking text message. I would have to tell Amy. I tried to imagine the conversation. I would have to track down John's father in whatever city his rockabilly band was playing. I would have to track down his brother, assuming he's still alive. I would have to help arrange for a funeral and go through John's stuff. Or maybe I wouldn't have to do any of those things. Maybe I didn't owe him any of that because he had abandoned me. After he had talked me down half a dozen times, here he was taking the same easy way out he'd scolded me for. That was his final message. "It turns out you were right. There is no other escape. Why don't you just fucking..." There was a noise from the direction of the bedrooms. Footsteps. Chapter 7. The Battle of John's Living Room. John walked into the room carrying a package of cookies. He said, "Hey, do you like Oreos? There's something I want to try." I jumped out of the chair and backed up toward the kitchen. I looked back and forth from dead John to alive John. I said, "Back the fuck up." John gestured toward the corpse with a cookie and said, "He's not real." "What's the password?" "It's Bushmaster." "But that doesn't matter. He knew it too, and the real Ted is still alive. The password thing doesn't work. The clones or doppelgangers can imitate that, the same as everything else. I think they can dig into your brain or something." I said, "Don't move." I cautiously approached and poked the standing John with a finger to see if he seemed solid. He did. To be sure, I wrapped my arms around his torso and squeezed to detect any anomalous reaction. I found none. "Okay. Yes, it is good that you are not dead. That is a positive. Wait, what's this about Ted?" John glanced down at the sofa. "Wait, who do you see there?" "I see you. Dead from a drug cocktail." "Huh. I see Ted. Face blown off from when I shot him." "From when you what?" John circled back and told me the entire story. I dropped back into the armchair, staring off into the middle distance, trying to make sense of it all. First of all, the entire roof of the church didn't blow off. I was there afterward. It was one corner, a few chunks of roofing and plywood. Second, did you say when you opened the door that doves flew out? Like in a John Woo film? Are you trying to parlay this series of events into a movie deal? What matters is, I find out 5 minutes later that the real Ted is still alive. I talked to him. It was the exact kind of trick we were expecting. It's kind of encouraging. I feel like we were ahead of them this time. Wait, now how do you know the alive Ted is the real Ted? If the password thing doesn't work, what you really mean is, how do you know I'm me and that's not really me there on the sofa if the password thing doesn't work? Oh, shit. Wait, if you were the doppelganger, why would you tell me the password system doesn't work? You'd have kept that to yourself to use against me. Maybe I'm stupid. The fucking conversations we have. Okay, how about this? I ask you something that John would know, but that I, or a replicant, would have no way of knowing. Something we can verify right now. Like what? Where's your drug stash? Why, Dave, you know that I would never... God damn it, John. Owl jar above the toilet. That way if I have to flush it, it's right there. A trip to the bathroom confirmed this was true. When I returned, John continued. As for me and Ted, he just showed up out in the middle of nowhere. His car wasn't there. He just kind of materialized behind me. That's the thing. It used my state of mind against me. I was in such a panic. The whole flimsiness of the pretext was hidden from me until way later. And then you killed him. Or it. Whatever kind of shapeshifter this is, it can be killed, is my point. And it stays dead. Shot to the face. Pretty straightforward. Yeah, nobody likes that. I looked over at the corpse on the sofa. So what is it? Specifically. I mean, there's what each of us is seeing, and then there's what it actually is. Something new, maybe? We'll need to come up with a name for it. It's my turn. Later. The naming of new creatures we encounter is something of a contentious issue. For now, what do we do with it? He thought for a moment. I wish we could get it to Marconi. That's Dr. Albert Marconi, a famous expert in this sort of thing. He rarely returns our calls. I said, sure, let's just cram it into a box and mail it to him. Wait, how did you get it back here? In the Jeep. Did you throw the corpse in your Jeep and drive it back here after you figured it out it wasn't Ted Knoll's body, or before? What was I supposed to do, leave him out in the rain? But if you thought it was just a dead guy, a guy you shot, shouldn't you have called the... You know what, forget it. John said, we need Amy's brain on this. Is she still at work? No, I don't know where she is. Wait, Amy's missing? Why are we dicking around here then? She's not missing, she's out with somebody. They swung by and had breakfast, apparently. I don't know where they went. Phones were down. Who's she with? I don't know. I thought maybe she was with you.
You're not worried?
It's not like she was abducted. They ate a meal together.
Like she left with somebody she knew, you mean? Or something she thought was someone she knew?
Oh, fuck. Fuck! I dug out my phone and dialed. It rang through, but she wasn't answering. So help me, John, if all this shit was just a diversion so they could take Amy... Something grabbed my wrist. It was John, the dead one, from the sofa. Dead John's mouth opened so wide that his head was about to split in half. Then a second, vertical slit opened from his chin to forehead, his entire face opening like a blooming flower. His skull was hollow, the inside covered in tiny, wiggling filaments. The thing howled with its whole face. The floor shook. I grabbed at the fingers clutching my arm. Some of the fingers came off, then grew tiny wings and flew away. I was only mildly surprised by that. Dead John's body contorted as if it was a clay model that a giant pair of invisible hands had decided to give up on and start over. For the briefest moment, I saw what I thought was a pulsing swarm of small creatures, each about the size of my palm. But then they were gone, and so was John. A new figure replaced him. John screamed, "Nymph!" Ted had described Nymph as a foppish sexual deviant. John had described him as a sleazy stockbroker type. To me, he looked like me. Not exactly me, a fit, tan, healthy version of me with an expensive haircut. A version of me that hadn't gone off the rails, wearing a nice shirt and pants instead of a stained t-shirt and cargo shorts. Yet I saw my own eyes and the scar on my cheek. He said, "Greetings, knuckle fuckers." John said, "Where's the little girl? And where's Amy?" Nymph smirked and said, "The master must feed." "I don't care what you named your dick. This shit ends now." "Indeed it does," said Nymph. "Granted, the mere chewing of their flesh takes only 66 days, but once consumed, their souls live conscious in the belly forever, for it is their anguish that nourishes the master. But don't worry, I will release one of the two of your choosing. At this moment, I am posing this same dilemma to the mother and father of little Margaret. The four of you are voting. The girl with 3 votes will be released. The other's screams will echo through eternity. If no one receives a majority vote, both will be consumed. Someone must vote against their own to save another. So what will it be? You have 1 minute to decide." I said, "Wait, what if we refuse to vote? What if everyone refuses?" "Then the master will gorge on a double portion. Is your vote for your Amy? That is a vote to sentence a child to an eternity of torment. How will your Amy live with that choice, I wonder?" I said, "Take me instead. Let both of them go and take me." He did that smirking head tilt thing douchebags do. "Come on, even you must know that your meat is tainted." John said, "I vote for both of them to go free." I said, "Yeah, me too." "That is not one of the options." Nymph looked at his wrist. He was not wearing a watch. 45 seconds. Of course, the confounding factor is how little Maggie's parents will vote. Perhaps anticipating that you, as selfish assholes, will vote for your Amy, they will as well, knowing that then at least one can be saved. John said, "Wait, I vote that the monster eats you." I said, "I vote that the monster eats itself." "Those are not the fucking choices. 30 seconds. I said, "All right, I'm voting Amy goes free." John said, "No, the monster is right.
Even if Maggie's parents vote the same, there's no way Amy can live with herself knowing she's alive because some other little girl is getting chewed up forever. There's no way she can live with herself if she's dead. And you'd be surprised what a person can get over if given enough time to think up rationalizations.
No, I wouldn't.
10, 9, 8. I said, John, you have to vote.
Wait, does Dioji get a vote?
John said, I vote for... My phone rang. The screen said it was Amy. I answered. Amy, is that you? Nymph's mouth snapped shut in mid-countdown. He had not been anticipating this. Amy said, Hey, I've got a little girl here. She's fine, but I need you to come and get us.
Amy, listen to me. There's something after you. You and the little girl both. You need to...
I've taken care of it. We're fine. We're at that church by the old coal mine. Oh, and I need you to stop by Walgreens and pick up my prescription. They said it's ready. And can you get me a bag of those chocolate-covered pretzels while you're there?
John.
John heard Dave say, Amy, is that you? And felt the world shift on its axis. Nymph, standing there with his Gordon Gecko suit and slicked back hair, sneered and turned in Dave's direction. The call had clearly not been part of his plan. John saw his opportunity. John lunged for one of the chainsaws above the mantel. They were very much not just there for decoration, even if, as decoration, John thought they kicked serious ass. They were always oiled and gassed up, ready to go. See, one thing John had learned about the various creatures they'd faced over the years was that almost none of them liked being sawed in half by motorized metal teeth. Simple biology, really. John grabbed the chainsaw and performed a move he had spent hours practicing. In one continuous motion, he started the motor, spun, and swept it through Nymph's midsection. He met very little resistance. The whirring blade buzzed horizontally through the man's belly, and then the top half of him was nowhere to be found. Everything above Nymph's navel just dispersed. What had been his torso was now a swarm of fist-sized buzzing creatures whizzing frantically around the room. John looked back at where Nymph was standing and saw that half of him was still there. Everything from the waist down remained where it had been, including the man's expensive slacks and patent leather shoes. The legs started walking toward John on their own. Then one of them whipped upward and kicked the chainsaw from John's hand. Disarmed, John lunged forward and grabbed Nymph's lower body by its belt loops, intending to lift up the legs and chuck them across the room. Then they too began to dissolve from the bottom up. Nymph's feet dispersed into those flying insects, which still appeared to be made of black polished leather. The ankles were next. John followed the flight paths and saw that the shapeshifter swarm was swirling toward the far corner of the room. There, they were quickly reforming into something new. Something made for fighting. John saw teeth and claws and spiked armor. John screamed, Dave, get the... But as usual, Dave was already 5 seconds ahead of the situation. He had the t-shirt cannon in his hands and was already aiming it at the rapidly assembling creature in the corner. Dave aimed carefully. One shot, Dave. The cannon's payload was not, in fact, a t-shirt. It contained the Shroud of Turin, the legendary piece of cloth that the body of Christ was wrapped in after crucifixion. Experts were divided as to whether or not the shroud was real or a fake, produced during the Middle Ages, an era when selling holy relics was all the rage. That was probably why John had managed to buy it for just $150 off eBay, which he thought was a good price either way. Listing, actual Shroud of Taurine, stained with sweat of Jesus. Good condition, free shipping. Wow. John was still uselessly clutching the hips of the rapidly disintegrating Nymph, his legs almost entirely gone now, and watched as Dave fired the shroud. It worked perfectly. The projectile unfurled itself in midair, the white cloth stained with the image of a knife-wielding Christ enveloping the creature. The monster howled, the contact with the holy artifact burning it and binding it. John, still holding his remaining hunk of Nymph, ran over to it and, with a scream of rage, mercilessly beat Nymph with his own ass. The insect creatures dispersed. The swarm fled toward the open back door. John dove toward a brass switch on the wall. He flipped it. Flames roared from the four corners of the doorframe. The bugs flew through the blaze and tumbled burning onto the lawn, shriveling up like lit tissues. John watched them burn and yelled, "Me. And don't make me ask you again." Amy made a skeptical noise and said, "Just go with it. That's mostly what happened. It was really confusing." Amy said, "I can't breathe. You're squeezing me." I released about 20% of the hug, but kept my arms around her. We had rolled up to the church at Mind's Eye to find Amy sitting under the portico of the front entrance with Maggie Knoll, both of them looking like they just swam up out of the ocean. Maggie seemed sluggish, like she'd been drugged, staring off into space. She was shivering and seemed to know only that she was wet and cold and wanted to go home. Amy pulled away and said, "She was down there, around the mouth of the mine, hidden under the water." I said, "Really? How did she, you know, breathe?" "They had an apparatus hooked up." John said, "I can see it now. She wasn't drawing a picture of where she was going to be held. She was drawing a picture of what she would see. The view of the church as seen from down there, under the water. Maybe she had dreams of it happening in advance or something." We were talking about Maggie as if she wasn't sitting right there. But she made no effort to shed light on the situation. She had this blank look, and I had the alarming thought that maybe she had suffered brain damage from lack of oxygen or God knows what he, or it, or they had done to her. John said, "I was so close, right here, where we're standing." I said, "To be fair, when searching for the lair of an unholy creature of the night, who would have ever thought to look around the haunted old coal mine?" "I would have figured it out. The thing with Nymph got in the way. That's probably what he was doing, leading me away from her." Amy was already walking away with Maggie. "Let's get her home. Her parents are probably worried sick. David, can you drive the Impala?" "The what?" I saw she was walking toward Ted Knoll's cherry red muscle car, which was parked behind the church, the car he had reported stolen earlier today. Amy climbed into the back seat so she could be there with Maggie for the trip, putting her arm around her and trying to keep her warm. Maggie laid her head on Amy's chest and closed her eyes. I slid into the Impala. John went to the Jeep. In the back seat, Amy closed her eyes, like she was just going to doze off back there. As if I didn't still have 1,000 lingering questions about all this, I said, "So you figured this out all on your own? How'd you even get out here? Who drove the car?" She heard me. I know she did. But there was this long moment before she answered. Almost as if, say, she was quickly trying to come up with a cover story on the fly. She said, "I came home from work and there was a thing there, pretending to be you." "Wait, what? Holy shit, Amy! I saw through it right away. It was all wrong. I tried to get away, but it put me in the car and took me out here. Probably was going to stuff me under the water with her and whoever else he collected." "Jesus, Amy, I should have come right back home. I should have known they would come after you." She closed her eyes again and said, "So, I got away and I was able to get her up out of the water and up the hill. Then I called you. That was it. I thought it would come after me, but maybe it couldn't. Maybe the church repels it or something." "You got away?" She didn't respond, even though it was clear I was asking for her to complete the story. I said, "Amy, that's really all there was to it?" "Yeah, that's mostly what happened." We rode in silence the rest of the way to the Knoll house, shockingly only about 5 hours after I had been awakened by the call from John. Now, if John was telling this story, he'd probably say that the moment we arrived, the rain stopped and the clouds parted, as if the weather changed for everyone else just to reflect our personal triumphs and failures. But it didn't. It was that same drumming rain that had been slowly turning the town into brown gravy for the last month. I wondered if Maggie and her parents were going to have to celebrate her rescue by evacuating to higher ground. Amy took Maggie by the hand and led her up to the front door. John and I followed. Ted and Loretta both came to the door, for one morning the couple having reconciled in the face of the outside threat. Loretta threw her arms around her daughter, and Ted threw his arms around them both. I said, "Did Nymph appear here, demanding you and Loretta pick which girl gets saved?" Ted said, "No," and Loretta shook her head. "Huh, so that had all been bullshit." He said, "You get the son of a bitch?" John said, "Let's just say he won't be coming back around. Not after he made such an ass of himself." "He what? Is he dead or not?" "Yeah." Ted said to his daughter, "You hear that, honey? He's all gone. The bad man is gone. You're safe." She pulled away from her father. "No, he's not. He's right there." Maggie turned and pointed directly at me. Book 2. An excerpt from Fear, Hell's Parasite by Dr. Albert Marconi. To understand what occurred, we must ask ourselves a simple question, one which is surprisingly difficult to answer. Why do we, as humans, have eyes? Your natural response would be to see things, you doddering old fool, but as an answer, that is incomplete to the point of being incorrect. Your eyes fool you on a daily basis because they, quite simply, were designed for a very specific and, for the most part, obsolete purpose. Remember, the vast majority of species on this planet do not have sight and get along just fine without it. You have no evolutionary need to become aware of the world's general appearance. You, as Homo sapiens, have eyes primarily so that you can find and kill other living beings. The prey we hunted, gazelles and the like, have eyes mounted on the sides of their heads so that they can see predators coming from all directions. Ours face forward and grant us depth perception to measure the distance between ourselves and our fleeing dinner. The true, deadly purpose of human sight is also the reason the color red attracts our attention. It is the color of blood, the sight of which would have instantly sent up an internal thrill of alarm or elation, depending on the circumstance. Thus, today you see that hue screaming for your attention from stoplights, fire trucks, and fast food logos, a calculated appeal to your hardwired bloodlust. All of this is to say that our sight is very limited, precisely because it is skewed to serve a few specific functions, all of which are geared toward one singular goal: survival. Thus, data that is not immediately relevant to that mission is filtered and discarded. You may have seen 1,000 automobiles on your commute to work this morning, but you will be unable to bring a single one of them to mind. Unless, of course, a particular vehicle had swerved into your lane and caused a near-death experience. It is literally a form of tunnel vision, the limits of which you are largely unaware of moment to moment. It is therefore not difficult to circumvent this sense we call vision. Even the common flea can effectively vanish before our eyes merely by jumping. It does not take any special intelligence or talent to deceive us. We would do well to remember this. Now, extend this concept to the way in which you see the world in a metaphorical sense. The internal idea you have of the universe as you would describe it to an inquisitive alien. Remember, the brain and consciousness also evolved with survival in mind, to the exclusion of all else. Thus, your mental perception of the universe suffers from this same tunnel vision. It is in no way geared toward producing an objective view of reality. It only produces a view of reality that will help you survive. You will see the universe that you need to see. This is not a metaphor. It is an indisputable biological fact born out of necessity. Whether you see the universe as pure or corrupt, peaceful or violent, just or unjust, is largely determined by what you need to believe in order to motivate yourself to continue living for another day. Your perception of reality is therefore also very easy for other beings to hijack for their purposes. Think of the relationship between a cult leader and his followers. He will isolate them and make them believe they are an island in a sea of depravity, that signs of an imminent apocalypse are all around.